At Mount Vernon, we ascend the stairs in the room in which Washington died. Uncovering our heads, we enter. We feel awed into silence, for we believe the place where we are standing to be holy. The 1865 account of a Union soldier who had participated in Sherman's March to the Sea and who arrived in Virginia shortly after Abraham Lincoln's assassination shows that he thought of George Washington's home not as a southern landmark of a fragmented country, but as a symbol for all Americans. What was it like to live in Mount Vernon in Washington's time? And how did the estate evolve from a working plantation dependent upon slave labor to a national icon? I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. With me is Gene B. Lee, professor of history and senior research fellow at the Institute for Research in the Humanities faculty in the UW Material Culture Program, University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also the editor of the book Experiencing Mount Vernon, Eyewitness Accounts, 1784 to 1865, published in 2006 by the University of Virginia Press. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Well, let's pretend for a moment that you're a real estate broker and that I'm a potential buyer of this place called Mount Vernon. Walk me through it. Tell me what's there. What are the strong points? What are the weaknesses?
Today, the site is approximately 500 acres. In Washington's lifetime, it was 8,000 acres. What one sees today was what was called the Mansion House Farm. It included the mansion and the outbuildings, the laundry, there was a blacksmith shop, the stable, quarters for slaves who worked on that particular part of his lands, and fields and crops. The place changed a lot over the course of his lifetime. He inherited the plantation from his half-brother, Lawrence Washington, and by the 1760s, he was beginning to add to the slave labor that he had already acquired by inheritance. He was buying slaves. When he married Martha Washington about 1759, she was the wealthiest widow in Virginia, and she brought much property, plantations near Williamsburg, also slaves, and lots of cash to her marriage. And Mount Vernon expanded as a result of that, so that on the eve of the Revolution, by the time he went off to the war in 1775, there were approximately 100 slaves on the plantation. By the time he died, there were over 300.
And how did the estate, how did the property come into the Washington family's hands in the first place?
The property dated back to a 17th century land grant to the original Washington, who emigrated from England, and another man, a Mr. Spencer. And over time, as usually happened, the original land grant, which was about 8,000 acres, was divided from generation to generation among sons and other kin. And so by the time Washington inherited what was known as Mount Vernon, it was about 2,200 acres. And he immediately set about reassembling that original land grant. And by the end of the War of the Revolution, he had largely succeeded in doing that.
Now, about this half-brother, Lawrence, what prompted him to leave the estate to Washington, who was much younger, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Well, they were close. And Lawrence had been involved in the Caribbean in some earlier conflicts between the British and the Spanish. And it was there, through Lawrence, that Washington developed an interest in the military life, at least so far as we are able to ascertain from the records. And Washington, George Washington, as a child, lived part of the time at Mount Vernon. So he was already familiar with Mount Vernon. Actually, the estate, Lawrence's estate, passed first to his widow for her use during her lifetime, and then when she died, it descended to George Washington.
And he seems to have set about right away to expand it then?
Yes. that was clearly always his goal, even when he was in the Army. And he learned that there was a piece of land that had been a part of that original grant. He was writing back and forth to the man he left in charge of Mount Vernon when he was gone, a man named Lund Washington, a cousin. And he was clearly very eager, and even in the midst of war, to acquire that tract of land so that he could reassemble what he might have called the land of his fathers.
Well, of course, we remember that Washington was a surveyor, too, so he must have been very land-conscious in the first place.
Oh, right, absolutely. And the Fairfax estate was nearby, and he was a surveyor for the Fairfax lands up in the northern neck of Virginia, which is where Mount Vernon is.
Was Washington unusual and Mount Vernon unusual in that so many of the Virginians have this reputation, Jefferson in particular, of being property rich and cash poor? Was Washington unusual in that regard?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And he could do things with Mount Vernon that he probably would not have been able to do, except for the fact that, as I said, he came into land, slaves, and cash, a rather liquid estate in Virginia, through his marriage to Martha. And to give you a specific example, when he decided in the 1760s that he didn't want to grow tobacco anymore at Mount Vernon, he could experiment with grain production. And that wasn't originally very profitable. But the Custis plantations, because it was Martha Custis Washington, the Custis plantations were still very productive, and he sold tobacco from that. And under 18th century law, as the husband of the widow Washington, he had a right to use of her property. And he did. He took that responsibility very seriously and kept meticulous accounts.
I get the impression, though, that she would not have been averse to that. She seemed to be very much, attached to George Washington.
Absolutely.
From early on.
Yeah, absolutely. They seem to have had a wonderful relationship. So wonderful that before she died, she burned all of his letters to her.
Thanks
from the
a
war.
Lot.
Except for one, which was found much later in the back of a desk drawer, and a desk that she had used. She missed that one, but all the others were gone.
Well, let's digress that much. What was in that one?
It's a letter written when he's about to go off to the encampment in Massachusetts around Cambridge and Boston. This is right after Lexington and Concord, and that was in April of 1775. And as soon as that event occurred, minutemen and militiamen from throughout New England converged on the area and held down the British in Boston. And the Continental Congress, of which he was a member, the brand new Continental Congress of the colonies, met the next month in May of 1775, and in June they created the Continental Army. So he then went off to the Army and was the only commander-in-chief of the Continental Army through the entire war. And he, at this point, he wrote a letter to Martha in which, as was typical of many of his letters, he says that he's not up to the task and he's concerned about how he will be remembered, what his reputation will be, that sort of thing. It's a loving letter in its own way, the way he addresses her.
You mentioned earlier, Jean, that he decided at Mount Vernon to stop raising tobacco. Was this because the land was played out? Tobacco is notorious for that, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't. It depends how you handle the land. If you don't add fertilizer, and manuring tobacco wasn't very much recommended during those days for obvious reasons. The other thing you could do would be to let the land lie fallow, and southern planters tended to do that, and it might lie fallow for 10, 15, 20 years, and fertility would be restored. To northerners looking at that, it seemed like completely unproductive and unnecessary. So it just depended. Actually, his interest in doing something other than tobacco production had more to do with his being a tobacco planter in Virginia with mercantile connections to London. And the way that worked, he would, as all of the other planters who traded directly to England, he would send his tobacco off every year to his mercantile connection, and he would in return order a very long list of things, everything from plantation tools and cloth for slave clothing to very fancy items for Martha and her children. Well, he would never know when he went sent the tobacco off what it would be sold for. So he would never know until he got the bill for the goods whether he had come out ahead or behind. And at one point, he became quite indebted to his English firm. And debt was something that he abhorred. And so he began experimenting to try to get himself out of dependency on this kind of trade. And almost at the same time, you have the beginning of the run-up to the revolutionary crisis, the Stamp Act crisis, the colonies beginning to respond with things like, well, we're not going to import British goods. We're going to use our economic power to make the British change their mind, the Townsend duties. And so his personal animosity toward indebtedness, plus his growing sense that he is not satisfied with a dependent economic relationship within the British Empire, come together.
This, of course, was a very prosperous plantation. Does that imply that the slaves on the plantation lived better than they would have in a less prosperous place? How did they live? What do we know of their day-to-day existence at Mount Vernon?
That's a very difficult question to answer because the slaves rarely spoke for themselves, if at all. And so as is typically the case when we're looking at slavery, all of the information comes through the master sources and other white sources. It would depend which part of the slave population one was looking at. The slaves that lived on the Mansion House plantation, which is Mount Vernon today, were slaves who were house slaves, who were artisans, bricklayers. There was a miller nearby who was a slave during the colonial period. And especially after the war, when he was famous, there seems to have been some effort to make sure that the slaves were properly clothed and fed and that sort of thing. On the other hand, on the outlying plantations, we don't know a whole lot about that, but there's one example that I can remember that suggests perhaps that things were not as good as on the Mansion House farm, and that is he had a favorite slave driver, in other words, a black slave who took the position of overseer. His name was Davy, and Davy lived in a house on one of these outlying farms that was so ramshackle that there was concern it was going to fall down. And nevertheless, it was months and months and months before anything was done about that house. The visitors' accounts, and there are over 100 visitors' accounts between the Revolution and the Civil War, eyewitness accounts to Mount Vernon. And for the Revolutionary period itself, they vary. There is a Polish visitor named Ninkowitz who said that the slaves lived in hovels worse than the Polish peasants. On the other hand, there are other visitors who said that the slaves lived well. Now, that's a comparative term. To give you a specific example, Frank, who was a house slave, had a room in the cellar, but he did have a private room. So obviously a huge disparity between what the Washingtons and their guests surrounded themselves with compared to the really quite humble, very humble circumstances in which the slaves lived. For food, they probably ate better than other plantations. Washington had a very strong idea that if slaves did the work that was required of them, they were entitled to proper food, not excess, but proper food. And also from archaeological work at Mount Vernon, we know that slaves ate a lot of fish from the Potomac River. The Potomac just teemed with fish in the 18th century.
We should actually digress here enough to say exactly where Mount Vernon is.
Oh, okay. Where is Mount Vernon?
It's with the Potomac.
It's on the Potomac River, and it's about 15 miles south of Washington, D.C. today, about 9 or 10 miles south of Alexandria, Virginia. And Mount Vernon itself is located on a high bluff above the Potomac. The river in front of that bluff is about a mile wide. And in the colonial period and into the post-war period, Washington operated a ferry across the Potomac to Maryland. So it was a, to him, he said more than once, it was the most pleasant place in the world. And to this day, very large ships can come up that river. So he had access to the world of the transatlantic world of commerce literally at his dock.
Were there, you mentioned the slave Davy and his accommodations, were there other slaves whose names stand out over the passage of time?
My favorite is a woman named Charlotte, and she lived on the Mansion House farm, and she was feisty. And Charlotte was trained as a seamstress as part of his efforts in the 1760s to make Mount Vernon more self-sufficient, less dependent on foreign goods brought in from England. He encouraged knitting, weaving, seamstress operation, and Charlotte was a fine seamstress. I think she made 9 shirts a week or something like that. She also learned fine needlework under the supervision of Martha Washington. And here's the story about Charlotte. And one reason I like this story is so much because you really see the person behind the name and the fact that she was a slave. Charlotte wanted the weekly allotment of meat early. And she was smart enough to ask Davy, who wasn't living at the Mansion House, but she knew Davy, and she asked him to go and ask the man in charge, while Washington was president, that she wanted her meat early. And the overseer took offense at that and said he wasn't going to do it. So when on the weekend she got her meat, she immediately took it to the overseer's house and threw it down on the steps. He took offense at that. And he whipped her. So Monday came, and she refused to work because she'd been whipped on the thumb. And so the overseer whipped her again, and then he had second thoughts because somehow or other this information would get to the Washingtons. And so he then immediately wrote off to George Washington and gave his side of the story, including the fact that Charlotte had threatened to tell Mrs. Washington about him, and she was a custis slave. So Mrs. Washington had some influence over what might or might not happen to Charlotte. So I would have to say she's my favorite, because that and several other episodes, you really have a sense of a person who's complex, who changes over time, something that, especially for the 17th or 18th century, that's not often that historians are able to get to that depth.
Did Washington take slaves into battle with him?
He had a slave that he had purchased in Virginia in about 1767. It was Billy Lee, a young man, and he was later known as William Lee. And William Lee learned how to be an excellent horseman, and he was also Washington's valet. And Washington took him wherever he went, and he took him off to war. So Billy Lee saw the entire war. We know that he was a fine horseman. He raced against Native Americans in camp at times. He also had some kind of a contraption, a big eyeglass, I guess one would call it, that he carried around the battlefield so they could spot the British. And there's one example where Washington turns to someone and says, well, Billy's going to get shot today, because he was exposing himself. After the war, he came home with Washington. And he had fame in his own right. He had known Nathaniel Greene and other generals. He had known Lafayette. And he had been wherever Washington had been. And so visitors to Mount Vernon wanted to talk with him. They wanted to hear from him personally what he had experienced and what Washington was like. And also his favorite activity was talking to veterans, Revolutionary War veterans, who came by Mount Vernon to pay their respects and chat with George Washington, and they always looked up Willie Lee or William Lee as well. He is the only slave that Washington manumitted or freed immediately under the terms of his will.
We're going to look at Mount Vernon as a working farm or set of farms, find out how well they worked, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Support for WPR comes from Madison Opera, presenting Opera in the Park on Saturday, July 17th at 8 p.m. in Madison's Garner Park, featuring familiar opera hits, the best of Broadway, and highlights from the upcoming Madison Opera season. Information at madisonopera.org.
Tis Washington's health, loud cannons should roar, and trumpets the truth should proclaim. There cannot be found, search all the world o'er, his equal in virtue and fame. There cannot be found, search all the world o'er, his equal in virtue and fame.
Washington has something uncommonly majestic and commanding in his walk, his address, his figure, and his countenance. His face is characterized, however, more by intense and powerful thought than by quick and fiery conception. There is a mildness about its expression and an air of reserve in his manner. He is 64, but appears some years younger and has sufficient apparent vigor to last many years yet. From the journals of Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who visited Mount Vernon in July of 1796. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Gene Lee, and we're looking at Mount Vernon in the time of George Washington in particular. First question that comes to mind that we haven't touched on yet, Gene, is where did that name come from, Mount Vernon?
Mount Vernon. Mount, of course, it's on a high bluff. The Vernon comes from the name of a famous British admiral, Vernon, who was involved in the same conflict in which Lawrence Washington went off to the Caribbean and fought. And he came home then and named his plantation Mount Vernon. It had, prior to that, there were a number of names attached to the property, including one was my plantation on Little Hunting Creek. So
not quite
but
as
once
catchy.
It was, right. Once it was Mount Vernon, it stayed that.
Now, once George Washington inherited Mount Vernon, the estate, from his brother, his half-brother, Lawrence, you mentioned already that he set about expanding it, restoring it, you might say, to its original size and scope. But was Washington an innovator in terms of the agricultural application of the land of Mount Vernon?
Absolutely, and I don't think that that's sufficiently recognized about Washington. I don't think it's sufficiently recognized how visionary he was, from small details like what crops would be grown at Mount Vernon to his vision of what the new United States should look like or what he hoped it would eventually become. He begins with a very ordinary Virginia plantation. When he married Martha, he began expanding the house and tidying things up a bit. And at the same time, he was always interested in how work was accomplished, what was the most efficient way to do it. He would sometimes sit down and watch workers saw wood or do something else and record how long it took when he was there compared to how much they produced when he wasn't there. And believe it or not, they always produced more when Washington was watching. And he certainly was interested in the transatlantic commerce in the 1760s, at least the early 1760s. He's very much interested in it. He was interested in the settlement and the laying out of Alexandria as a typical Chesapeake port town, a small town, but a town that had very important trading connections. By the 1760s, he's also interested in growing wheat, as I said, and establishing a milling operation. So he's more expansive in his ideas about what agriculture should be practiced in Virginia. And then, of course, he decides that because of having gotten more indebted than he wished to be, I think the amount was 1,800 pounds sterling, something like that. He then decided that he wanted to establish self-sufficiency for himself. And when you think of it, one of Washington's goals was to establish self-sufficiency for the United States, both independence, but after independence, viable nationhood.
So what's he growing other than tobacco?
He grew a lot of grains, and he experimented with grains, timothy and buckwheat, and he actually was an experimenter in that he might take three small plots right next to one another, put a different amount of enrichment for the soil, whatever he chose, record how deep the seeds were in each of the three plots, and then he'd wait to see what happened. So eventually, he grew, or at least experimented with, over 60 crops at Mount Vernon. And oats, also textile crops. He grew cotton there. He grew flax, which is used to make linen. So you can see just from the range, he's using wheat and rye, corn for grains for the families that live there, but also textiles, feeding livestock. And then the other thing that he did, that land was prone to erosion, and that troubled him deeply. And he decided that cutting down the trees and making fences was not a proper way to go. And so he started then having his slaves actually plant shrubs and trees and make what he called live fences. So he then experimented with all kinds of trees. By the time he came home from the war, of course, he knew an enormous number of people. And he was very famous, and people wanted to help him in any way they could. And so he received wheat from Russia, a mule from Spain, Pennsylvania crops, South Carolina crops, and he experimented with all this at Mount Vernon.
And apparently made a commercial success of it then, despite a period of indebtedness?
It depends what time you're looking at. There certainly was no commercial success that has been identified for the war years, which
would
not be at all
order.
Surprising. Yeah. For a long time, he didn't really know whether he was making a profit or not into the 1790s. And then finally, about 1793, he realized that he was making a profit. However, by that time, his slave labor force had grown so large that he said he had at least twice as many slaves as he needed. Well, why did he have that many? Because normally a planter would simply dispose of, through gift or more likely sale, a slave considered surplus. Well, during the war, Washington, who spent most of the war in the North, became acutely conscious of slavery and Northern labor, which he thought was very efficient. And he made some decisions during the war. He hoped, even during the war, that he could somehow divest himself of his slaves. And I'll explain that in a minute, because there were the Custis slaves, too, and he could not sell them. So he actually thought of divesting himself of slaves, but he didn't. And eventually he said that he would not break up families, and there were many slave families at Mount Vernon over the years he was there. And furthermore, that he would not sell slaves off the plantation without their permission, and nobody gave permission. Now, those were only Washington slaves that he bought or inherited, or children of those slaves that he had the legal authority to sell. The Custis slaves belonged to the estate of her first husband. And so he could use those slaves and maintain them, but he could not sell them, and he wouldn't have done so anyways.
Well, it sounded as if he was taking an economic hit then, if he had more slaves than he needed.
Yes, he definitely thought so. And he toys with the idea of, Lafayette proposed to him shortly after the war that they buy a tract of land somewhere, maybe out in the West, and they free some slaves and they make them tenant farmers out in the West. And Washington said, well, that's a good idea. But nothing came of that, although Lafayette went ahead and did buy land in the Caribbean and established that kind of experiment.
Washington is celebrated as a meticulous record keeper. What do we learn from all those notes of his over the years at Mount Vernon?
The part of his record keeping that I find most fascinating is the correspondence, not the diaries, but his correspondence. Secondly, I would say the weekly work reports he required for the five farms of the plantation. Each of one had each one had its separate overseer. And there's a record of who was sick, how many lambs were born, how many shirts were made, what the workers were doing. And for people who are interested in plantation agriculture, that is an absolutely fantastic record. The correspondence is, I believe, as far as I know, unique in this sense. When he went off to war in 1775, he didn't come home again until the year of Yorktown, and then only briefly. He comes home for what he thinks will be for good in 1783. But of course, we know he went off to the Constitutional Convention. Then he became president for two terms. I think that totals to about 16 years of being away from Mount Vernon. But Mount Vernon was very, very close to his thoughts, and he was a hands-on manager, whether he was in the Army or whether he was the master of Mount Vernon. And so we have an enormous amount of correspondence between the chief person he always left behind until the 1790s. It was always a kinsman, and then it was a hired help. But he, as president, reserved part of every Saturday afternoon to read these reports he was getting from Mount Vernon about what had been produced there and who was sick and all of that kind, and who had a baby, etc. And then he would write back very detailed instructions and commentary. That's the kind of information that doesn't exist from most plantations, because it was word of mouth between the master. And if there is that kind of information, it's usually very scattered and slim. It's overwhelming for Washington, and it's just a treasure trove.
What was in it for him to leave that wonderful place, Mount Vernon, that he described as, you know, being the best place on earth? What was in it for him to leave that and become a part of the revolution?
Well, by the time he left to go to first the Continental Congress and then to become commander-in-chief of the Army, he was very disenchanted with British policies with regard to the colonies, taxing without representation, the Declaratory Act, in which Parliament declared itself supreme in all cases whatsoever. And there were constitutional developments and arguments on the side of the British, which few Americans pay much attention to. But he was very much in favor of, well, he didn't know it was going to be a long war, first of all. Nobody did. But he certainly wanted to do something to see whether the British could be dislodged where they were, which was the British Army was in Boston. The other thing is, we know that 18th century elite men, shall we say, yearned for fame. And Washington was very touchy about his reputation. Almost every time he took on some major challenge, going off to be president or going off to be commander-in-chief, he expresses concern that he's doing this and he's not up to it, and he doesn't want, or he's worried that his reputation will be hurt. And this is part of it, too. I mean, he knew fairly soon, because of what the Revolutionary War was meant to accomplish, once you have the Declaration of Independence, he knows that one way or another he's going to be famous. And at that point, he becomes assiduous in keeping track of his own records. And they're not all there, but it's an enormous amount. It's something like over 250,000 items in the Washington papers. That's an 18th century collection.
Was Mount Vernon ever in danger during the Revolution?
Oh, yes, it was. Well, there was that wide Potomac, and the Potomac could not be protected. It was too wide and it was too deep, and so it was vulnerable to British ships, British warships. And there were warships in the Potomac off of or near Mount Vernon in the summer of 1776, the summer of independence. And then during the war, the British came up the Potomac several times, particularly the year of Yorktown. And at one point, a British warship trained its guns on Mount Vernon and threatened to torch the place. And nobody knows what happened because the record is not full. But Lund Washington, the cousin who was in charge of the estate while Washington was at war, went on board the British ship with foodstuffs from the plantation. And somehow or other, the guns were lowered. Washington was furious when he heard this because, oh, the thought that somehow or other his farm manager would be treating the enemy in that way was just infuriating to him, and he let Lund Washington know it.
So just a little bit like a bribe in some ways, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Right.
Washington was famous for that Olympian temper, wasn't he?
Yes, he was also famous for his ability to control his emotions. But yeah, and in fact, from what I've read in the records, people who knew him were more impressed with his ability to control his emotions and the care and thought with which he approached a topic or a controversy than the fact that there was a temper. But yes, he could certainly, there were times. And I say when I teach this course, I say to college students that he's one of the best complainers I've ever encountered in the written record because
a lot to complain about,
he
though.
Had a lot to complain about, and he did. And he didn't suffer quietly often. But, of course, he persevered. He persevered tremendously, and he really is the indispensable man of the Revolution. It's impossible to think of the Revolution taking the course it did without Washington being there at such critical times. Just take, for instance, the presidency. Without Washington at the Constitutional Convention and the knowledge that he would likely be the first president, the presidential office almost certainly wouldn't have had the strength that it does under the Constitution.
A case of the man lending prestige to the
Absolutely.
Office instead
yes.
of the other way around, as yeah. it eventually became. Washington ran a distillery for a while, didn't he? At Mount
he did. Vernon? One of the people he hired. He had not only slaves at Mount Vernon, but he had white workers as well. And some were Virginians or Marylanders. He had a miller who came from Pennsylvania at one point, and he also brought people over from Europe. And he had a man who was a Scot who they had all this corn and wheat and that sort of thing that they were milling, and there was all the leftovers. And the pigs were getting really fat on it. There's a visitor's account that said the pigs' bellies dragged on the ground because they had all this leftover from the milling operation. And so this Scotsman convinced Washington to build a brewery, which he did right near the granary. And that has since been just recently reconstructed at Mount Vernon. And the Smithsonian Institution had what they think is the original still or one of the original stills. And that's now at Mount Vernon in the reconstructed distillery. It's about 3 miles from the plantation house itself.
I think you can actually buy that blend, can't you, at Mount Vernon, but nowhere else?
I have no idea.
Worth some investigating.
Right.
We're going to look further at Mount Vernon in Washington's time and after when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Washington Island Ferry, a lifeline ferry service crossing Death's Door Passage year-round to Door County vacation destinations Washington Island and Rock Island State Park. Information on the web at wisferry.com.
The passage to Mount Vernon was uncommonly delightful and heightened by the appropriate music of a full band of the Marine Corps. There was no heart that did not harmonize with the occasion and throb with emotion. At Washington's tomb, a solemn silence pervaded the company, which was broken only by the heat of a muffled drum at the door of the vault. After the music ceased, there was an involuntary lingering round the spot, and the hearts of all were melted when, looking up, they saw a veteran of the Revolutionary Army mingling his tears with those of American patriotism. A description of an event, a commemorative event, at Mount Vernon, July 4th, 1823. party that included Revolutionary War veterans, French diplomatic officials, and a Marine band that arrived at Mount Vernon aboard the steamboat Washington. And that description from a member of the party who recorded how the visitors commemorated the 47th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Gene Lee, and we're looking at Mount Vernon in Washington's day and after. It is a place that had a reputation for quite the social life in Washington's day.
Yes, it did. Very much in line with what we think of in terms of southern plantations. And people would come, sometimes with advance notice. After he was famous, they would just come. And he was always ready to offer food and perhaps a look around the plantation and dining with the Washington family in the evening, conversation, that sort of thing. And then some of the guests stayed for the night. And one part of the mansion was actually set aside at one point for visitors. I believe that the number is something like over 400 visitors a year came to Mount Vernon. I that could be an exaggeration, but that's the number I remember. He said in one of his letters that his house was a well-frequented tavern.
What was the family like at this point, if we get into, well, the years leading up to the Revolution? Who's actually living at Mount Vernon? Okay.
Martha Washington was a widow, and she had four children who came to Mount Vernon, and they grew up at Mount Vernon. And then as those children matured and married and had families of their own, by the end of the senior Washington's lifetime, they were beginning to have their own families, and they too then would come to Mount Vernon. So it was very much a family circle. And in addition, for what they're called the FFVs, the First Families of Virginia, there was so much connection through marriage that everybody was a cousin or a relative of a cousin of everybody else among the elite. And so people would come and visit at Mount Vernon as to other places. And this was very much ordinary. What became extraordinary after the war was the number of people who came by, and also that some of them were foreign visitors, people from England, people from Poland, people from France. The future king of France, Louis-Philippe, came at one point, I believe it was 1798, and they came because of who Washington was and what he had accomplished and the fame that he had, even among the Englishmen. And Washington really constructed what I call a cultural landscape at Mount Vernon. That is, he used Mount Vernon after the war as a stage. It was a stage where people could see evidence, living evidence, and other evidence of the Revolution itself. Washington, Martha Washington, who were sociable and entertained their guests graciously. William Lee, the slave. And then all of the memorabilia that Washington had brought home from the war, including his camp tent and his military correspondence and battle flags that had been taken in surrender, those hung on the walls at Mount Vernon. So in a way, Mount Vernon was a museum. And he used this backdrop with all these visitors, particularly over dinner and after dinner, to talk about his vision of the United States and what he wanted to see for the country. And so it was a very lively place. I believe it was in 1799, not too many months before he died, that he said something very unusual was going to happen that day, and that is that he and Martha Washington would dine alone.
This is the first time in a long time.
Long time.
And it was after a tour, which I guess was a routine thing for Washington to do, to tour his estate?
Every day.
Was it not after one of those tours that he contracted his final illness?
Yes, that's right. That's right. It was, well, he died in mid-December of 1799, and he had been out, and it had been a wet, rainy, probably sleet-filled day, and he came home, came down with a sore throat, and eventually it was so severe that he died. And Martha was in the room with him, as were some of the house servants.
At this point, both of her surviving children had already died at relatively young ages, hadn't they?
She had a daughter who died before independence of epilepsy. She had been a very ill young woman. And Jackie Custis, Martha's son, died. He contracted camp fever at Yorktown and died at a Custis estate nearby Yorktown. And Washington was there and utterly anguished at the death of this young man.
And so Martha Custis Washington, 1799, when George Washington dies, that's the end of the immediate Mount Vernon family, isn't it?
That immediate family, yes, because some of the heirs, Nellie Custis is the famous owner of, she and her husband are the famous owners of Woodlawn Plantation, which was part of Mount Vernon originally. That was given to them when Nellie Custis and her husband married. So, yes, when Martha dies, which is in 1802, the estate was divided, and Bushrod Washington, a nephew and a Supreme Court justice, received 4,000 acres of the original 8,000. And he then lived at Mount Vernon with his wife until they both died in 1829.
Is it still a prosperous plantation at this point?
No, it was never again a prosperous plantation to the extent it had been in the Revolutionary period. Bushrod was bookish. He wasn't all that interested in agriculture. He was often gone for a good deal of the year because he, as a Supreme Court justice, he had to attend to his legal duties. So the estate really, in some ways, during his time there, almost became the putative property in a way of the American people because they just came, even though it was a private estate. And he was a private man, and he wasn't thrilled with this kind of public intrusion on his property. You can imagine, you know, opening the window in the morning and there were 50
tourists.
People on your front lawn. And he eventually had battles with steamship companies and banned them from coming, turned congressmen away because it was the Sabbath. And he posted and published a notice about 1822, saying that he had been terribly affronted by eating and drinking and frolicking on the front lawn and that he would not tolerate this as a Virginia gentleman. So the tension between the public, which is in the process of appropriating Mount Vernon as its own, at least in imagination, and Bushrod Washington was fairly intense. That would lessen after his death when the estate passed to one of his nephews, because he and his wife died childless. That man was named John Augustine Washington. He was in ill health and died in 1832, and his wife, Jane Charlotte Washington, inherited the place and ran it until one of her sons was old enough to take over. Jane Charlotte is really important because she is the first to articulate the importance of Mount Vernon for the nation as a whole. And she grew tired of living there, she said, because she felt like one of the curiosities of the place. But she gave very serious consideration to whether there might be some way in which Mount Vernon could become national property. Also, she is the one who regularized the visiting experience. Instead of just letting people amble here and there, they entered usually at the west gate to the plantation where they were met by an African-American, slave or free black, because all of the successor heirs brought their own slaves to Mount Vernon, plus there were some that never left Mount Vernon after Washington died. And eventually they were given a quarter, and then as people went to the house, they were met by other African-Americans who took them around the grounds and pointed out things that Washington had planted and where he had walked and that sort of thing, and then they ended up at the tomb. So that became a very important ritual, and it's really, as far as we know, the foundation for the kinds of historic site visitations that we have today. Mount Vernon was probably the beginning of all of that.
Well, here's an account from a New England visitor to Mount Vernon in 1834. As I passed about the grounds and stood before the tomb, I thought how many illustrious individuals had passed in the very footpaths I was traversing and had stood where I then was. And I paid a tribute of gratitude for a free and independent country. I thought of the good Lafayette, of Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, and I doubted whether ever another man would live in America whose memory would be so clearly cherished as that of George Washington. Despite that, well, maybe in part because of it, didn't the family at one point try to sell Mount Vernon to the state of Virginia or some other
entity? Let me summarize, because it went on for years and it's fairly complicated. The American people really made Mount Vernon a shrine. They used religious kinds of vocabulary. They talked about it as their Mecca, the heart of America's soul. They talked about Washington's birthday as their American Christmas. So it was the American people who were pushing to do something that Mount Vernon be preserved. And of course, it was private property. And in the 1830s, the family began to think about it becoming a national site and be sold to the nation. Well, there was no precedent for this kind of thing. Today, this happens, but there was no precedent for this. The 1830s, that's also the time of the secession crisis in South Carolina, increasing tension over sectional issues. And there was a small problem in the United States Constitution, which was that any property in Virginia that would be alienated or sold to the federal government, the Virginia legislature would have to approve that, and that never happened. And so, to make a long story short, for years, the family and various people tried to figure out a way how Mount Vernon could pass into national hands without necessarily being federal property. And at every turn, they did not meet with success. There was a petition drive in the 1840s where petitions are in the National Archives. There's tens of thousands of names of people, including from Sheboygan County, Wisconsin, who pleaded with Congress, please, to do something to preserve Mount Vernon. Jane Charlotte Washington's son, John Augustine Washington, who took over farming there in 1843 and then inherited it outright in 1855. He was very interested on behalf of his mother in seeing if there could be some kind of sale, because by now people were complaining that the Washingtons weren't keeping the place up and it was costing a lot of money. And the family was getting very tired of, by now, 10,000 people a year showing up at Mount Vernon. And when it was clear that nothing was going to happen at the national level, he negotiated then with the state of Virginia in the hope that Virginia, which had claimed Washington of its own as its own and certainly didn't want his bones to lie elsewhere. Nevertheless, the Virginia legislature didn't do anything about buying Mount Vernon. And it's at that point, in 1853, that a South Carolina woman was passing Mount Vernon on a steamship in the night, looked up, saw it in disrepair, and went home and told her daughter, Ann Pamela Cunningham, about it. And Ann Pamela, a single woman, a spinster, as they would say in that day, made it her life work to rescue Mount Vernon. Rescuing Mount Vernon wasn't really very difficult because it was so much the nation's sacred place by this time, that they actually easily raised the purchase and preservation money, even at a time of economic depression in the United States in the 1850s.
And it became actually, if not sacred, neutral ground during the Civil War.
It is the only property known to be continuous neutral ground between the Union and the Confederate armies, which is extraordinary because a lot of the war and a lot of the troops were within 1 or 2 or 3 miles of Mount Vernon for a good part of the war. Ann Pamela went back to South Carolina. You couldn't have a South Carolina woman running Mount Vernon during the Civil War. They took over, I forget now whether it was 1860 or 1861, but right at the time of the Civil War. A New Yorker, a woman named Sarah Tracy, then became the mistress of Mount Vernon during the war. And she had presence because when soldiers showed up, she required them to stack their guns against a building and don shawls so that when they entered the sacred grounds, they didn't have any other clothes. They were soldiers. But when they entered the sacred grounds on their visit, they then would be coming as citizens and not as soldiers.
Jean Lee, thanks for sharing the hour with me and enlightening all of us about Mount Vernon. Perfect conversation for the 4th of July.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join Emily Auerbach and me for the next hour. of University of the Air. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 as we look at the controversial life and career of playwright and novelist and poet James Baldwin. That's next Sunday afternoon at 4, University of the Air, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.